It's January 1952, the final year of the Truman administration. Inside the Department of Justice building in Washington, H. Graham Morrison watches an old man step haltingly into his office. His visitor is 77-year-old Thomas Watson Sr., who has been CEO of IBM for nearly 40 years. With him is Tom Watson Jr., Watson's 37-year-old son, and the heir apparent at IBM. Morrison runs the government's antitrust division and is known to aggressively punish monopolies. The elder Watson takes in the scene with dismay. He's used to calling on high-priced lawyers who wear tailored suits and work in spacious offices decorated with oriental carpets and mahogany furniture. Lawyers at the Justice Department get unimpressive paychecks, buy clothes off the rack, and squeeze into their cramped offices. The bare floors and metal desks amplify the sharp sounds of typewriters clacking. Morrison invites Watson and his son to sit. They settle in on hard wooden chairs. Morrison and his lawyers believe IBM is a monopolizing, anti-competitive company that dominates the data processing industry. They want to charge IBM with violating the Sherman Antitrust Act. The Watsons' business depends on convincing Morrison he is wrong.
Well, Mr. Watson, by my count, you've now had 116 people, including just about everyone I've known since childhood, call me at night and say, "Don't bring this suit against IBM. Mr. Watson is an aged man. It'll kill him." But it doesn't seem like I have to worry about that. You look quite well.
I don't know what you're talking about, Mr. Morrison. I've never had anyone call you.
Oh, yes. Of course you didn't. Of course not. Now let's get on with it. What brings you here exactly?
My son Tom is going to handle this.
Tom Watson Jr. sets an easel on Morrison's desk. On the easel, he places a set of diagrams. One chart shows a triangle defining IBM's market as the entire range of business calculations. The bottom third of the triangle is labeled pencils and ledger books. The middle third is adding machines, posting machines, bank teller machines. The narrow point at the very top represents IBM's business-making tabulating machines, the computers of the day. As Watson Jr. explains it,
if you count all of this as our industry, then IBM only controls about 16% of the market.
Watson Jr. finishes, and a heavy pause fills the room. Morrison is unmoved by the demonstration, maybe even a little bit annoyed. Then, Morrison lays out some of his department's complaints.
Mr. Watson, the way we see it, by making machines that can only work using IBM punch cards, IBM is preventing others from making and selling cards, and is forcing customers to buy cards from IBM. And here's what else. By controlling or buying patents, IBM has killed off potential competitors. You know what you're doing. By leasing machines, IBM blocks the development of a secondary market in used IBM machines, parts, and services.
Morrison gives him a moment to absorb the direct attack, and then he pulls the pin.
On the facts, IBM really deserves a criminal suit.
The words hit the elder Watson like bullets from a machine gun. They take him back to the greatest shame of his life. In the 1910s, the government convicted Watson and other executives at National Cash Register of criminal antitrust. Watson barely escaped a jail sentence. Watson is clearly shaken. He speaks quietly.
No, this can't happen.
I will not dismiss the suit or accept a consent decree as offered by your lawyers. You will not undo my 38 years of building IBM into a company that is admired around the world. That's fact.
The old man looks like he's about to cry. But Tom Watson Jr. sees it differently from his father. He thinks an antitrust suit might be just what IBM needs right now. This is Business Wars. I'm David Brown. You're You're listening to Episode 3 of the First Computer Wars, IBM versus the UNIVAC. Watson Sr. has for years put his legacy and the very existence of IBM in danger by holding on to control of the company for too long. U.S. military and government business helped build his company. And now, the Justice Department is telling him it is prepared to take it down. This presents an opening for his son, who had been badgering his father to modernize, to change, to step aside. Watson Sr. concedes some power to his son, but has planted landmines. Watson Jr. is frustrated with reporting to his father's yes man, a polite and well-mannered executive named George Phillips. One day, Tom Watson bursts into his father's office.
God damn it, you've got your secretary as the president of this company. He'll agree to something I want to do, then talk to you and reverse himself.
Phillips had been the elder Watson's personal assistant for nearly 40 years. The elder Watson installed Phillips as IBM's president for only one reason: to be a buffer in the volatile relationship between father and son. It's 1952, and Tom Watson Jr. has been working under his father for 7 years, taking on more and more responsibility. He believes he's ready to run IBM, and he sees his father as an aging man attached to a technology that is fading away fast. If IBM doesn't change soon, the company will fade away too. In fact, each day that passes, Watson Jr. grows more certain that IBM needs him to take over. He knows the time has come to challenge his father for the helm. Telling his father that Phillips has to go is him throwing down the gauntlet. The young man practically flinches, expecting his father to react the way he always does, by exploding and blasting back. But this time, the elder Watson stays calm. He asks his son to wait in a small room next to the office, then calls in Phillips. Watson Jr. hears muffled talking, but he can't make out what they're saying. His father asks him to come back in.
We've decided to make you president.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
What's the matter? Don't you want the job?
Tom Watson Jr. is clearly upset. He had imagined that his father would make him president in a satisfying formal ceremony. This improvised promotion leaves Watson Jr. hurt and disappointed. He got what he wanted. Now, he just needs to do the job. It doesn't take long for him to face his first challenge. On Tuesday, January 22nd, 1952, he picks up the front page of the New York Times and sees the headline, "Trust Suit Charges IBM Monopolizes Tabulating Field." Now the Justice Department has done it. It's filed an antitrust suit. It charges IBM with unlawful restraint of trade and monopolizing the tabulating machine industry, meaning IBM allegedly used its dominant position to lock out competitors and stifle innovation. Both Watsons know the article will upset and worry employees. So, the elder Watson, still the chairman, writes a letter to IBM employees and orders it published on the front page of the company's in-house newspaper.
We have never employed any measures to eliminate or restrain competition. We reject as unfounded any construction of our business conduct as in violation of the antitrust laws and intend to vindicate our position in the courts.
As the letter makes its way outside of IBM, it comes to the attention of James Rand, the CEO of Remington Rand and Watson's arch rival for nearly 3 decades. Rand reads Watson's words and shakes his head. Nothing would make him happier than seeing IBM broken apart and Watson humiliated. As Rand recalls, Watson began his anti-competitive ways back in the early 1900s, when Watson's company made the world's first tabulating machines. The mechanical contraptions could count the census or sort out train schedules. The business had virtually no competition. Only one rival, the Powers Accounting Machine Company, maintained a toehold, and Watson worked hard to kneecap it.
Rand remembers how Watson manipulated the situation. Watson hoarded patents that made it almost impossible for Powers to compete. Then, once Powers had felt the pain, Watson paid a visit to Powers and offered to license patents for a fee of 25% of Powers' sales. Powers had no choice but to accept. Ever since, Watson always pointed to this deal as a magnanimous gesture, telling audiences at lectures and meetings that it proves IBM welcomes competition. But the deal saddled Powers with 25% higher costs per machine than Watson's company. It was as if Watson agreed to let an opponent stay in a foot race with him as long as his opponent ran with his shoelaces tied together. Powers nearly collapsed from the deal, and that's when James Rand swooped in and bought it. His battle with Watson was on, and he's fought Watson as an underdog ever since. But now, well, now he can feel the situation turning. The government is about to fire a legal broadside at IBM, just as Rand is introducing its first electronic computer. Remington Rand's machine, the UNIVAC, is far faster and more powerful than any of IBM's aging technology. Rand thinks, finally, I have the upper hand on Watson. Thomas Watson Jr. is in his first weeks as IBM's president. He sees the moment differently than either his father or his father's nemesis. Watson Jr. sits in his new president's office and reads the government suit. He realizes that all of the charges concern IBM's past and current products, tabulating machines and punch cards. Electronic computing is soon going to make all those products obsolete. Settling the suit would mean IBM would have to make difficult changes to its business. Yet, Watson Jr. believes such changes would be mild compared to the dangers of fighting a drawn-out antitrust suit in court. Watson Jr. avoids saying as much to his father, but he thinks that settling the suit might actually help IBM. Watson Jr. knows that as long as the old machines remain a lucrative, protected business, well, his father is going to be reluctant to leap into the next age, where competition and uncertainty lurk. But if IBM signs a consent decree that doesn't cripple the company, but does make the old business look vulnerable, well, Watson Jr. can nudge his father aside and aggressively move IBM forward into the age of electronics. Watson Sr. can't separate the best interests of IBM from his visceral need to scrub his name of any taint of antitrust. In one meeting after another, Watson repeats his stance.
No, I will not settle. It would be an admission of guilt, and IBM has done nothing wrong. We will fight the suit to the finish, and when IBM is exonerated in court, the government will owe IBM a public apology.
Dad, a court battle would be disastrous for IBM. In a competitive market, IBM's actions might be good for business, but if the court finds us to be a monopoly, the way we do business will be considered an abuse of power. If we lose, the government could break the company into pieces.
But we will not lose, and we will not settle.
Tensions over the suit escalate until father and son can barely stand to be in the same room. Then, one morning, the elder Watson arrives in his office at 9:30. He sees that his son is getting ready to leave. Watson asks his son where he's going. Watson Jr. replies, he is going to the federal courthouse to talk to the government lawyers and the judge about that antitrust case. The elder Watson blows up. They get into a raging argument.
You're totally incompetent to do that.
God damn it, old man. Either tell me you want me to go and I'll leave, or tell me you don't and I'll call and cancel.
No, you go. But don't make any decisions.
Watson Jr. storms out and takes the elevator downstairs. He walks through the lobby, steps out of IBM headquarters, and stands on the New York sidewalk, unsure of what to do. He walks a while, trying to think and stop shaking. He considers the possibility of quitting IBM. He's that upset. After walking and thinking for blocks, Watson Jr. hails a taxi and directs the driver to take him to the courthouse. While Watson Jr. is sitting at a conference table with the lawyers and the judge, one of his father's secretaries rushes into the room and hands the young Watson a slip of paper. The son unfolds it, with everyone staring at him, and reads it. Six short phrases are stacked on top of each other like a list. It says, 100%, confidence, appreciation, admiration, love, dad. It is, finally, the elder Watson's acquiescence. IBM is now Tom Watson Jr.'s company. And there, in front of the lawyers and the judge, the son's eyes well with tears. Left to do what he thinks is best, Tom Watson Jr. settles the antitrust action in a way that barely slows IBM's existing business and leaves the company free to compete hard in electronic computing. Thomas Watson Sr. has never flown in an airplane. It terrifies him. Tom Watson Jr. can't get enough of flying. He flies his own plane whenever he can and flies on airlines for business every chance he gets. He is about to board a plane out of New York when he sees Red Lamont, one of his father's old-time executives, rushing through the airport calling to him.
Mr. Watson, the U.S. Census Bureau is buying James Rand's UNIVAC computers to replace IBM punch card machines.
Oh, God, I knew this was coming. We're so far behind in electronics, we're starting to lose even loyal customers. The Census Bureau, how long have they been with us? Since the very beginning.
That's not even the worst news. It's part of a government program against us. 14 U.S. organizations are developing computers, and they're all backed in some way by the government. Some of that money's going to university labs. Some's going to new computing companies. And some is going to...
Yeah, I know, to Remington Rand and the UNIVAC. It's this damn Korean War. It's got the government scared that IBM won't be making the best computing machines. It's funding every competitor.
Upset, Watson Jr. boards his flight. IBM has suddenly found itself in an unaccustomed position, looking at James Rand's backside. Tom Watson thinks through Rand's tactics. Rand is playing the situation perfectly. And it started when IBM failed to buy out or hire J. Presper Eckert and John Maukley, the University of Pennsylvania professors who built the very first electronic computer. Think of it. Just a couple of years before, Eckert and Maukley left their university jobs, started their own company, and promptly ran out of money and approached IBM for help. You'll recall that Thomas Watson Sr. practically threw them out of his office. Rand had the foresight to swoop in. He took a very different approach. Rand invited Eckert and Maukley to his home in Florida and took them out for a luxury cruise on his yacht. And while still on the boat, Rand cut a deal to buy out Eckert and Maukley. The duo would join Remington Rand and get the money they needed to build the UNIVAC and bring it to market. Now, Eckert and Maukley are testing the UNIVAC in their Philadelphia lab, a cramped room made so hot by the machine's thousands of tubes that engineers work in their underwear. That first machine is destined for the Census Bureau. Remington Rand has orders for another 3 UNIVACs, vaulting Remington Rand past IBM into the lead in electronic computers. Back in New York, Tom Watson Jr. takes action. There is no time to lose. IBM's future is at stake. He goes to his father and demands that IBM pull resources from every other project under development and put everything on building IBM's first all-electronic computer. A military version of this machine is called the Defense Calculator. The version for business is the IBM 701. The 1952 election is coming up soon. By 1953, a new administration will take over in Washington. Tom Watson Jr. wants to have IBM's electronic computer ready by then. He wants to convince the new government to throw out Remington Rand and turn back to IBM. He tells IBM's engineers to break all of his father's old rules and processes. Speed is everything. The 701 has to be designed and built faster than IBM has ever built a new machine. It has to be introduced in the first part of the new year. Watson Jr. fails to see the embarrassment coming IBM's way. Because in Philadelphia, where Remington Rand is building the UNIVAC, one of the engineers approaches James Rand with an unusual idea. The engineer believes the UNIVAC can take an early sampling of votes on the upcoming election day, when Dwight Eisenhower will be facing off against Adlai Stevenson. The UNIVAC can run through equations derived from patterns in past elections and predict the result before all the votes are counted. Nothing like it has been done before. But what could the company do with that capability? Rand thinks for a minute. He's been fascinated by the mushrooming sales of television sets. Just a few years earlier, hardly anyone had them and very little programming existed. And now TVs are in millions of homes. Two national broadcasting networks, CBS and NBC, are reinventing entertainment and news for the new medium. Everything about television is experimental now. So maybe, just maybe, television would be open to trying a crazy idea on election night. Rand travels to CBS headquarters in New York. He sits down across from Sig Mickelson, director of news for CBS, and news anchors Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow. Rand explains how the UNIVAC works. The CBS men know a little about electronic computers, but not that much. And he makes his pitch.
So here's my proposition, gentlemen. Remington Rand can supply CBS with a machine that can predict election returns. We'll operate it and run the calculations. CBS will be able to tell the public who will win before anyone else. It will be a coup.
Mickelson is skeptical.
Mr. Rand, I know enough to know that's not true. No machine can predict the results with certainty. But might it help speed up our analysis of the election on election night?
Yes, of course. I know it can.
Cronkite seems less concerned about the machine's reliability.
I think it's a gimmick. But an electronic brain on our broadcast, that would be entertaining at least. It will get people to watch.
Mr. Cronkite, it would be better if you don't call it an electronic brain. That scares people.
Mickelson wants to make sure Rand understands the gamble he's making.
You know, Mr. Rand, if your UNIVAC flops, it will flop in front of tens of millions of people. It will be a disaster for you and your company.
Rand is thinking Mickelson's right. But if we succeed, it will be a disaster for IBM. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Business Wars. Next time on the first computer war, Tom Watson Jr. leads IBM on a mission to bury arch rival Remington Rand as the health of his father, Thomas Watson Sr., quickly deteriorates. You can subscribe now to Business Wars on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, NPR, iHeartRadio, Wondery.com, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You'll find a link on the episode notes. Just tap or swipe over the cover art. You'll also see some offers from our sponsors, and we hope you'll support our show by supporting them. If you'd like to hear more of Business Wars and other Wondery shows, in addition to extra content, early access, and exclusive perks, you can subscribe to Wondery Plus. I encourage you to do so. Go to Wondery.com/plus. That's P-L-U-S. Another way to support us is to answer a short survey at Wondery.com/survey. I'm your host, David Brown. Kevin Maney wrote this story. He's also the author of The Maverick and His Machine, Thomas Watson Sr., and The Making of IBM. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Sound designed by Bay Area Sound. Our executive producer is Marshall Louie. Business Wars was created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.